Well, like a great meal, a wonderful novel can keep you interested, pique your interest for what is going to come next, and just be an all-around enjoyable experience. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Michelle Wilgen has done exactly that with her new novel. It's titled Bread and Butter, and the fact that she's described incredible meals on page after page makes it all the more appealing. She is a writer, an editor. She teaches in Madison, Wisconsin, in addition to being an executive editor at the literary journal Tin House. She's the author of the novels Bread and Butter, of course, but Not for Long, another one, and You're Not You. And she edits, editor of an anthology, Food and Booze, a Tin House Literary Feast, and co-founder of the Madison Writer Studio. Busy gal.
It takes up a lot of time.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I really appreciate it. And I must say, I really enjoyed your book.
Oh, thank you.
It was a lot of fun. You and I want to give our listeners a chance to join in, so let me do that first. Maybe as you listen, you've already read this book or one of Michelle's other books, and maybe you have a favorite you want to ask her about. Have you worked in a restaurant? What kind of details would make a good representation of that experience for you? You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. You focus on three brothers in the book. Why did you choose that combination?
Well, good question. I think when I first sat down to do it, I was thinking in terms of maximizing my conflict for story. So, you know, I thought that that's a nice triangulation, and that way I could come up with some good conflict if I had two brothers involved in one restaurant and then another comes in and they're not all working together in one restaurant. And then I wanted to make their ages sort of serve that as well. So that's why the two older brothers are very close in age, and then there's a big gap between them and their youngest brother. And I didn't realize until much later that actually this is a little bit like my own siblings and me. But I wrote the entire thing with no idea that this was so similar.
That was not in the back of your mind when you wrote the book.
Well, it was clearly somewhere in there, but I was unaware of it.
So you have a lot of experience, restaurant experience.
I have at least
not for
some.
A while.
Yeah, it's been a long time. But, you know, I did the usual waiting tables to work all through high school and college. And then when I was finishing up college here in Madison, I wanted to go into food writing. I'd been reading a lot of MFK Fisher and Laurie Colwin, but I knew enough to know I knew nothing. And I was not going to be able to just go travel the world for 2 years and write about it. So I thought, well, I'm going to go to the best restaurant I can and hope that they teach me. So I went to work at L'Etoile and started as a back waiter, which is basically support staff on the dining room floor. And then I stayed for about 3 years.
Well, you picked a good restaurant.
It was the best one I could possibly find, yeah.
That's for sure, because that restaurant has continues even regardless of who's chef there or who's it's always been great. The restaurants that you chose for your book, you've got a kind of the new one is a kind of an edgy restaurant, as you say. The other one has been around, established. What do those kind of restaurants represent for you or to you?
Well, a number of different things. I mean, some of it with the one, Winesap is the name of the one that's been well established for like 10 years. And, you know, they do their jobs really well. They care a great deal about it. But there's that terrible feeling of suddenly realizing that all of your effort and all of your care is not falling by the wayside, but that you've sort of gotten behind on trend, that something else feels much more exciting, not just because it's new, but because it's doing something else really well, you know, and so it keeps you on your toes. And I think that just is that feeling of, you know, we all get as we get a little older and we get set in our ways and you think, oh, I'm doing great. And then suddenly you get very uncomfortable when you realize that you could do a little bit better. And then Stray is the sort of hip little joint that I was really interested in, these people who are willing to leverage all of their financial future and their time and their money to try and revitalize a struggling part of a city or even a struggling city altogether. And that's what Harry is trying to do by setting that restaurant in a really kind of rough and tumble part of the city. But at the same time, that gives it a real exciting feel. If all the parts come together and the stars align, you feel like you were an outlier and, you know, you were the pioneer that kind of got it going.
Yeah. And I really, one of the things I really loved about the book is sort of the backstory, all the people that work there, sort of what goes on in a high-end restaurant.
Yes.
That's sort of the backstory.
That was the big fascination for me when I went to work at L'Etoile, was that I had waited tables for years and I thought, well, how different can it be? And it turned out that there was so much effort that went into doing everything as well as you possibly could and to paying attention to all of the people who were your regulars, to paying attention to people who were kind of announcing themselves as becoming regulars. And it was just a fascinating world. You know, we knew what certain people liked to do. If somebody wanted to come in and just sit and have a martini before they even saw the menu, like, we would make note of that so that they didn't have to even verbalize that wish after a while. We would just do it for them. And yet the other side of that is that everybody who is often working in the kitchen or, you know, people who thrive in the restaurant business tend to be people who are willing to live in like a really intense environment. We work when other people are playing. You're up really late. You know, you kind of keep these college student hours. So there's a mix of high and low culture, I guess, all at once.
Well, it's really a fascinating look, I think. And I've had a little exposure to it just because of some experiences my wife has had as a pastry chef at a nice restaurant in town, and also some of my former students who are working in some high-end restaurants. And really the personalities I thought as I was reading your book, I thought, boy, you're describing a lot of people that I have actually met.
Good.
For me, that was really a lot of fun. I think the thing you do is you made me want to be in that kind of kitchen, that edgy one, and then also maybe to never be in that kind of kitchen.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredibly freeing because you can try out almost anything, but it's incredibly intense. You know, I mean, there's a line in the book where it says, well, it's really not that hard. You just do something perfectly and then do it 100 more times. And that's what restaurant work is. You know, you just do it exactly right, but then you repeat it over and over and over again forever. And you have to sort of thrive on that pressure and repetition and the craft of it.
Yeah. I'm talking today with Michelle Wilgen, writer, editor, and author of her latest novel. It's called Bread and Butter. And I really enjoyed reading it. I think you will, too. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments, your own experiences, maybe in restaurants or with her books. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. Our producer, Judith, said, who has had some restaurant experience too, the dating and the relationships that happen between waitstaff and others and the drama involved, mm-hmm, rang very true to her.
It rang true for me, too. I did not date anybody that I worked with because I was already involved with somebody else. But that is half the fun of deciding to write about the restaurant world, is that you get to write about all of the little wars that come up and the romances that might crash and burn. And the fact that usually people don't announce this stuff right away. So you have to kind of sit there and observe very carefully and see, like, oh, wait a minute. That behavior reveals something new to me that I didn't see last week between those two people.
Well, we have some callers online who are going to join in. Again, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. What focus was something at all three of the brothers are pretty focused, but the Harry is super focused, I think.
He's a little hyper-focused.
Yeah. Have you known people like that? Is that...
Oh, sure. You know, and I think I've certainly had experience with things that are both the the pro and the con for me when, you know, you are really intense about something, but then it's easy for that to start shading over into a little bit too much intensity. And Harry's, you know, manic attention to detail and his drive for everything to go well, I think is what makes him a success. But as the book explores, it also goes into overdrive. He and his own brother, who is his partner, doesn't know him well enough because they've been too distant for too long to help sort of reel him in. And so that's kind of a process of them getting to know each other well enough to work together.
Yeah. Brandon in Portage, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yes. I have one light question, which is there are actually three brothers in Madison who own several restaurants, one being kind of an edgy appetizer and grill. And Night Spot, and but they own some restaurants. I'm wondering, I don't really want to mention their names, but restaurants such as Notchfield, the Magnus, the Weary Traveler, they're all owned within, you know, owned and operated by brothers. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you actually might have received any influence or creative insight from them.
Yeah, you know, actually, I had long wanted to write a family novel, and I had long wanted to write a restaurant novel. And the first thing that had popped into my head was kind of the obvious thing, which is, oh, maybe I have some siblings who inherited a restaurant, and maybe they don't want to be in it. And then I just thought, oh, that's so typical. I'm so bored with that scenario. And I was aware of these brothers who don't all own the same places together. And I thought, oh, that makes it much more interesting. Because then you each, you know, you can express a vision. One brother can go off and express one vision and they could compete with each other and they might not always agree. And so I actually made it my business not to know anything about those people because I wanted to invent my own. But the very idea that you could sort of play a little bit more fast and loose with it did definitely inspire me.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Brandon, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And I'd forgotten about that, but that's exactly right. Bev in Fort Atkinson. Your turn, Bev. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you so much. Michelle, I just tried to email you over the weekend and your site wouldn't accept it, but I just finished You're Not You, your first book, and it just really affected me emotionally. I had times where I was kind of choking up and teary-eyed, and I don't want to ruin it for anyone that hasn't read it, but I thought the ending was as perfect as an ending in a book could be.
Oh, thank you.
And I just started your second book, and I'm just a few pages in, but I'm already enjoying it. But I don't. How did you come up with the idea for a book about a person, young person, suffering from, you know, advancing ALS?
You know, first of all, thank you so much for being so kind about You're Not You. And I had come across this because when I was in college, a friend of mine took a job working as a caregiver for someone with ALS. And so hearing about her experience brought forward all kinds of aspects of that that I would never have thought of, you know, just about how intimate it is, the emotional intimacy, the physical intimacy. And so I found myself really fascinated by thinking about this in a way that I never had before. And that was really what got me started on it.
Yeah.
And I had just mentioned to my reference librarian, we trade books back and forth in town, and I said this book was wonderful. And I said, you know, it almost sounds like it would be a beautiful movie. And then I just heard it is going to be a movie.
It is. Yeah. It's starring Hilary Swank and Emmy Rossum. And they just announced the distribution. So I think it should be out later this year.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so excited. Well, thank you so much. It was a pleasure to speak to you.
Oh, thank you.
Hilary Swank.
Yeah.
That's great. Did you get a hand in working with any of the...
I got a little bit of it. I mean, usually the writer, unless you're actually adapting it yourself, which I did not, often you don't even hear anything. You know, it's just sort of like, hey, what's going on? And there was a producer named Allison Greenspan. And for her, it was kind of a passion project because her father had had ALS. And so I think she worked really hard for a long time to bring this all together. And therefore, I would hear a little bit more about it than I usually do or than writers usually do. But otherwise, I got to see the script, you know, and I got to fly out there and bug them on the set for a day or so when they were filming, but that was about it.
I think Bread and Butter could be a movie, too.
I naturally think so as well. We will see. If we just keep saying that, maybe Hollywood will listen.
Jack in Green Bay, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to make a quick comment. It made me smile when I heard the talk of the book for Waiting Tables, and I've often thought everybody during some point in their lives really ought to wait tables to see what it's like, because it can be a very humbling experience. I've also felt the same about the military. I've done both, and maybe someday all these kids will have to wait tables, even for 2 weeks.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's all I wanted to say. I'll take some comments off the air.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Yeah. But
I totally agree, because I used to say that in order to vote, everybody should have to wait tables or work in retail. And then I realized, but wait a minute, a lot of people don't even want to vote. So no, it should be like in order to like have a glass of wine or something really fun, you should have to wait tables, because people are crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and I learned that waiting tables, and it makes me think very carefully about my own behavior when I go out. We suddenly become these people who are just bent on being coddled, and we act in very strange ways, and I would like to think that's not who we all really are at heart.
And on the flip side of that, if you've gone to a restaurant which is kind of to be a high-end restaurant, and it's when it first opens, you can run into the opposite. I can remember a very nice restaurant here in Madison ordering a steak and this is it's been open a few days. And the waiter said, "Well, what temperature would you like your steak?" And I said, "Well, medium rare." He said, no, I asked you what temperature would like your steak. And I said, "The temperature that's medium rare."
Yeah, that's
and
insane.
He looked at me like, I didn't know what I was doing and left. I thought, oh, gosh, I hope he doesn't last long in this.
Yeah, there can be that feeling of, well, that's like the reverse snobbery. You know, it's just like, how dare you come in and give us money in exchange for goods and services?
Oh, well, fortunately, that doesn't happen very often. But we have Timothy. We'll get to you in just a minute. You can join in, too, with your questions and comments as we talk with Michelle Wilgen about her new book, Bread and Butter. A wonderful book. I've really enjoyed reading it, and it talks about the relationship among three brothers, who among them own two restaurants. One is a new one, just getting started. The other, a very established high-end restaurant that's been in business for a while, and the relationships among the brothers, and also the relationship among the staffs or within staffs is really. Makes for some riveting reading, I can tell you that for sure. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller, my guest Michelle Wilgen, talking about her new book, Bread and Butter. Great to have her along. And thank you for listening in. Have you read one of her books? I hope you will join in. Maybe talk with her about that. Maybe you've read this book already. Have you worked in a restaurant? What about your experiences? What kind of details would make a good representation of that experience for you? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Timothy in Prairie Farm, it is your turn. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Well, I have not read any of her books, and they sound interesting. I like the idea of talking about restaurant experience. I'm single, and I enjoy making use of the coupon books that we have in our area to get a discount on some of the meals. But I had an experience where I think priorities of sometimes even the owners of the restaurant may be a little mixed up. I come into a restaurant and there you get two pizzas in this deal, and she was thinking it's a big group coming in. The owner was there, and she was so concerned that she would have to provide a couple boxes for the pizza instead of encouraging me to enjoy the pizza and enjoy the meal. So I was a little bit discouraged that that was her attitude. This was the owner of the pizza place in that I visited one time.
Hmm.
Yeah, I have to say, there are definitely those times when you just get caught up in the difficulties of your night and you look back and you think, did I handle that as well as I could have? Like, could I just have given somebody a box? And that happened to me all the time, I have to say. I'm sure that I got in little power wars with my my customers when I ought to have done a little bit better. So perhaps she was having that kind of night.
Yeah, it may be. And there are some characters in your certainly among the staff. Well, actually, the brothers, too, mm-hmm. In your book. one of the things I like is that there are a couple of women in the book who play very important roles. They're really the, you could probably call them the anchors or maybe the foundations of the men around them.
Mm-hmm.
Thea, maybe you can talk about Thea and Camille.
Yeah, so Thea is the executive chef at Winesap, and writing her backstory was one of my favorite things to do because, you know, the whole idea was that they had had this classic temperamental, you know, chef with a drinking problem beforehand, and Thea was just a prep cook when she began, and then Leo, the owner of the restaurant, just gradually noticed as the chef got worse and worse that the person who was really moving up and running the restaurant was Thea. And so Thea is basically this quiet but hyper-focused, does-not-mess-around kind of chef. And she doesn't do it by screaming at her staff, and she doesn't do it with theatrics. She just does it with perfection and high expectations. And so she is one of my favorite characters. I love her strength. I love the fact that she's just not there to play around at all. And I loved getting into her head after we see her in that really almost militaristic kind of role. And then we find out what she's mm-hmm. like inside. Meanwhile, Camille, who is somebody who starts appearing at the restaurant and catches Britt's eye, turns out to be a restaurant consultant. And I saw her for the first time in the same way that Britt did, basically as this sort of fascinating, beautiful, stylish woman, and was really curious to find out what lay behind that. And so I got a bit of a crush on her as well, I have to say.
Keith in Green Bay, thanks for calling. It's your turn.
Good morning. I just turned on the show, and I heard the comment about everybody should be in the military and wait table. My first job when I got out of college was as a management training program in a chain restaurant, and you had to do everything from starting as a busboy, cleaning out the grease traps, all the way up to the front of the house. And the most stressful was working as a line cook because you had to deal with the customers' needs and the waiters and the waitresses both.
Yeah,
and we all the people in the kitchen dreaded Tuesday because that was ladies' day at the theater. And the ladies would come in for the lunch special, which was a BLT and a soup of the day. And BLTs, the cooks hated because it was always, I want the bread extra brown, the bacon undercooked, no tomato, two lettuce, hold the salt. It was nuts because and things would come back, the bacon's too crispy. The bread's not toasted enough. It's like, and we would just go crazy. It was the most stressful day of the kitchen.
Yeah, and it would make the waiters crazy too because we knew the kitchen just hated us for coming back and saying, you know, the bacon's not crispy enough. And so you'd sort of dread both versions of it. You're like, you're never safe.
Thank you. This has been very interesting. Oh,
thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comment. Is there a level of focus that I think I look at all the restaurants in my neighborhood. Within a 10-minute walk, we can be in like 18 restaurants. I mean, we're in a really fun area to live in, to be perfectly honest. But most of these restaurants have been around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
They're all pretty good, which is, you know, why they've been around for a while. But there's a lot of restaurants that come and go.
Yeah.
What is it? I mean, what does it take to be? There's a level of focus, I guess, that.
Yeah, there's an incredible level of focus on so many different details. And I do think that because of the reputation or the idea that people have of what the restaurant life will be, I think maybe sometimes people get into it not really realizing what it's going to be like. You know, you'll sometimes hear people say, oh, well, I want to retire someday and open up a little restaurant where I just serve some, you know, pâté and French bread. I'm like, well, then you're not retiring. That means that you are actually working really hard all the time. And so people may have an image in their heads of it being one kind of life and it turns out to be another. But then it's also just a notoriously fickle industry with a really high failure rate. And I'm not sure why exactly that is. It could just be that the sheer level of difficulty makes for a lot of failure.
Yeah. You get so wrapped up. I wonder if sometimes there's a management component that I think sometimes might be lost a little bit in the, if the... if the owner is also the person who's doing the chef work or whatever. You are so busy.
Yeah.
There are so many hours of the more hours of the day that are taken up aside from even being open.
Yeah. And then you have to, you know, I always think of it in terms of the front of the house because that was where I worked, but that somebody has to be watching all of that. And so if you're on the line, then you have to be able to get off of the line and go out and see what everyone is doing. And are they waiting tables in the way that you want them to? And so I think you have to find a really good team. And that can be hard to do in an industry that doesn't pay all that well, too. That's another part of it. So, you know, the people that you're able to hire may not be... they may not stick around. You know, that's the other thing. There's a lot of turnover because the pay is low and there's always a great new place to go try out. So,
yeah. Yeah. Rich and Stevens Point. Hi. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call.
Oh, good afternoon. Thanks for having me. Michelle, on the other side of the coin, I self-published a book about working in the back of the house for about 10 or 11 years, specifically as a dishwasher. And, as many exciting and interesting things that can happen in the front of the house, all the kind of disgusting and filthy things seem to oftentimes happen in the back. And I was wondering if your book touched on any of that at all.
It does, actually. There's actually a pivotal scene in which the dishwasher breaks down, not the person, the actual device. But the dishwashers and all of the people who are part of running that back of the house are definitely a big part of it, because I really wanted to show all the stuff that we are not thinking about when we go out to eat.
Yeah.
Oh, excellent.
It's really,
I look forward to reading that.
Yeah, it's really, really a fun read from that perspective as well. You can join in 1-800-642-1234. I often ask, and I know listeners are interested in hearing about sort of the process that a person goes through in writing. How do your ideas come to you?
Slowly and with torturous effort. But I usually like to let them kind of sit in my head for a good long while, because I have found that if I start something a little too soon, then the magic kind of leaves it for me. But it needs to sort of build up a few layers and give me some idea of what the world will look like before I will actually start writing it. And in this case, it actually came together a lot like I pictured it. The first scene of the book of the three brothers in the soon-to-be restaurant space was the first scene that I wrote. And so... Enough thinking had gone into that and set up into the conflicts between the brothers and the way their world was set up that I didn't have to do as much complete wholesale revision as I sometimes do, where I might like change the world or make really big changes in their circumstances. In this case, it was really there from the start.
To your credit, at least I love the characters. I mean, I would love to have the story continue. Not that that you'll be able to do that or will have the time or even the desire to do it, but they're really nice people.
I have to say, I mean, I'm biased, of course. I like them quite a bit, but I love a funny character, and all these characters are really funny.
Yeah.
They're all really flawed and screwed up in their own different ways, which is what I think we want out of a good fictional character, because nobody wants to read about a perfect person. You want to read about somebody who is still fighting against being treated like the kid brother, even though he still is the kid brother, or the guy who seems perfect but then is completely lovesick over some woman who may or may not have noticed him. So I was just as fond of them as you are. So, you know, maybe I should just do a series of them opening restaurant after restaurant, you know, building an empire.
Rich in Manitowoc. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi. I've been running a restaurant or owned a restaurant for 23 years now. And, you know, there's a lot to it besides the day-to-day chores of running the restaurant. You know, the front end of it, the back end of it, and I do it all with two people. And you need a really good crew. And believe me, the characters that I've dealt with, you could write books and books about these characters. And today alone, I had to deal with a gentleman whose son committed suicide for the first hour of my day. So there's a lot, you know, the characters all have so many problems. And this was just a guy who always came in for coffee. And we never had a lot of dialogue, but it turned into something that really, you know, changed my energy, as opposed to, you know, going through the day just with faces coming in front of you as if I were working at a Starbucks or a McDonald's. It's a lot different when you actually own the restaurant and you deal with, you know, the people face to face every day, and you need to carry on a dialogue with them. So That was my comment, and I really appreciate her, you know, explaining this, that it's not a very easy thing to do.
Yeah.
It's a tough job for any number of reasons, and one of them, I think, is that we catch people at such an intimate moment. Eating is really intimate, and especially with a high-end place, you find yourself with people celebrating, with people having really big milestones, or... you know, just all kinds of moments that you have to navigate carefully. And, you know, it's a real public relations kind of job sometimes that you have to, or even a therapist kind of job, really.
Yeah. I mean, I actually gave therapy, and I do it on a regular basis to regular customers who all have issues that they need to talk to somebody. Mm-hmm. And when you're serving them their coffee and their scone, you're the guy. And it's almost like a set on a talk show, because they come in and expect you to solve their problems for them and, you know, listen to them. And it gets very draining.
Yes.
Well, you're doing good work, Rich. Thank you.
Right on. Thank you, Billy.
I appreciate it very much. See, now I'd like to stop in his cafe. Seems like a nice guy. Rob in Viroqua, your turn. Hi, Rob.
Hi there. Well, I just... my first job ever was a busboy, and my second job ever was I worked at a fast food restaurant, and it's just kind of disgusting and sad how society is, how rude and unthankful people are. Mm-hmm. I guess that's just, you know, one thing you notice, especially when my wife and I go out to eat and stuff, you know, we're thankful for the options and, you know, just, I guess that when you go out to eat, like in this country versus other countries, you know, I don't think a lot of people realize that.
Hmm. Michelle?
Well, I know exactly what you mean. I would like to think we were talking about this a little bit before, that, you know, the side of ourselves that we show sometimes when we are going out and we just want, that hopefully that's not who we really are at heart. But I think it comes down to just sort of a failure to empathize in some ways, and just to think like, oh, there's another person in my space and they are an actual person. And sometimes this comes down to something as simple as, you know, don't sit in a restaurant waving your arms around and inevitably run into a waiter who's walking by with a tray full of drinks. You know, just be aware of where you are and what people are trying to do. And I wrote an essay about this, and I didn't read the comments, but I was told that all kinds of people said, oh, well, then just get a different job. It's like, or we could just be polite as a society. This is also an option.
That's also an option. Rob, thank you for calling. Mary in Fond du Lac, hello to you. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Good morning. I just had a comment, and I've thought this many times for many years in a past life when I was waitressing, but I learned so much. We all know that comment, everything I ever wanted to know I learned in kindergarten, but I kind of make an adaptation of that, everything I ever wanted to know I learned through waitressing.
Mm-hmm.
Just because we anticipate needs, we learn to anticipate needs, we learn both sides of graciousness, we learn that there is such a cross-section of people out there in the world, so exposure to all sorts of different kinds of folks, and so years, probably 20, 30 years ago, I kept thinking, this is just a wonderful place to be, and I've heard other people say how important it is to go through that, and, you know, as part of your life training, and it has a lot to offer.
It does. You know, a friend of mine who I worked with many years ago, we were both waiters at L'Etoile, and she now is, she works for the UW Foundation. And I said, oh, well, you know, what prepared you for that? And she said, actually, it was waiting tables. It wasn't law school. It wasn't all these other things. It was having to learn how to deal with all kinds of different people, how to deal with problems, and how to graciously handle the nicer portions of an encounter. And she learned all those same things that you were describing, you know, as did I, as does everybody who actually does that job well.
Yeah,
absolutely. Exactly. Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. We have some on Facebook. Heidi wrote a cool comment. She says, one of my favorite scenarios as a server was when a guy left me his number in the tip line of a credit card receipt, but he didn't leave a tip.
Yeah. I think he's overestimating the value of that number, perhaps.
Not a good way to get a date, for sure. And then the restaurant experience in France is very different because people are so much more aware of the tables around them and the staff. Instead of just thinking about your own dining experience, people there think more about how their behavior is impacting the people around them. So talking more quietly and things of that nature.
Well, I have to say, too, that some of the service that I've experienced in France was really amazing. I was once there with a friend who was in a wheelchair, and I felt like the French servers handled it with such grace, and there was just none of this like, oh, how will we deal with this difficulty? It was just completely, you know, completely blasé. Like, of course, we will handle this. It'll all be taken care of, and perfectly gracious. And I feel like a lot of people could learn from that.
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of people are going to learn from your book.
Well, let's hope so.
I think they're going to learn a lot about, certainly the behind the scenes of writing, the writing you do about the behind the scenes things certainly rang true from my own experiences. And there were so many things that I thought, oh, I didn't know that. And what an interesting book you have.
Oh, thank you.
I really, and you're, and of course, you have a website, do you not?
I do, michellewilgen.com, and then also madisonwriters.com is the Madison Writers Studio.
And the Madison Writers Studio, how's that?
You know, it's been great. Susanna Daniel, who's another novelist here in town, and I started this last September. And what we wanted to do was offer really high-quality intensive classes, but you don't have to actually enroll in university to get them. So we're teaching fiction, nonfiction, novel, and so far we've had a lot of interest and great classes.
So you've had, and you're going to obviously be continuing that. So if someone out there is an aspiring writer and has some material,
then they should check out our class offerings or send us an email to see what we might have.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Yeah, I would guess that you would be pretty busy.
We've had great people. It's been the biggest surprise for me has been how fun it has been to just meet all the different people, especially in the nonfiction classes, because people come from so many different backgrounds and have so many different interests. And I, of course, get to enjoy them all.
And, you know, one of the things, one of the things I like to highlight, or one of the types of people I like to highlight here, are Wisconsin authors. And we have a lot of very good writers.
And I think more lately than there used to be, which sometimes, you know, we're kind of like, no, we've got plenty, we're good. You know, you don't want Madison to be overrun so that we want to keep it as enjoyable for us as it is now. But no, there are more and more every time I turn around, I feel like there's a new person who has moved to Madison and has recently published a great book or is about to. And it's really thriving.
And not even just Madison. I mean, there are some pretty good books here that have come out from, I was trying to think of the title, one book, a guy from northern Wisconsin wrote about a young man and his dogs.
Oh, Edgar Sautel?
Edgar Sautel.
Yes, that's right.
Well, there's an example of somebody from the northern part of the state.
Yes, and some of the, this is going to sound like a backhanded compliment, but it's not. It was some of the best writing from the point of view of a dog that I have ever read. It was incredibly, like, emotionally astute and beautiful, and you were completely invested in the dog's life.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was invested in the lives of the people in your book. Thank you so much for talking with us about it today, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bread and Butter is the title of the book, the author, Michelle Wilgen. And her name, by the way, is spelled like Wild, N-G-E-N, W-I-L-D-G-E-N. And go to her site. And your sites again?
MichelleWilgen.com and MadisonWriters.com.
I really appreciate having you with us. I hope we have a chance to do this again.
Great, thank you.
When's the next book coming out?
Oh, gosh, soon. I got to get going.
Oh, and what is it about?
Well, I think it's going to be about two couples who are left behind in a city after all of their friends have moved away. And then various things happen as they're kind of rocked to their foundations from that.
Well, look forward to it, Michelle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Michelle Wilgen, the book Bread and Butter. Great to have her with us. Really fascinating to get the behind the scenes in the restaurant. Take a look at the restaurant business, isn't it? Especially a high-end restaurant like that. A lot goes into a great dining experience. And when it's done right, you're not really even aware kind of what's going on. Coming up next, we're going to talk about another element that makes for a wonderful meal. that right bottle of wine. Jessica Bell of My Wine School back again to talk with us about wine. I hope you'll stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.